Okay, this is the last, hopefully. I don't think I'm going to continue on friendship. There's a group of sermons on this that elaborate on it on Daily Truth Base or on truthbase.net. So I entitled this A 3 Hours of Friendship to highlight just three aspects of being responsible for the relationship, being responsive to the other person. And then being reciprocal, where you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I asked these questions from the end at the beginning. One of the questions down at the bottom, which I did not put up top, but I'd like you to be thinking about this as we go through it, is, are you a friend of God? Would God call you his friend? You might call God your friend, but would he call you his friend? Because in order to have good friendships with others, you really need to be a friend of God, because otherwise you're just using people in your relationships. Does that mean that all unbelievers use each other in their relationships? Yeah, I think so. Even the ones that you think are very altruistic, they're actually using the other person to boost their own image of themselves as a good person. And, it's ultimately self-centered. Using a person for short-term gain is not really good. Investing in them for eternity, that's good. Okay, so Jesus gave us principles. Oops, I don't do this. Oh no, sorry. There we go. So that our joy would be full. There's the verses before this. Laying down your life for your friends, and he really wants us to have the fruit of the Spirit in us, and it comes really from serving each other. And I saw this a number of times in the past week as I interacted with body members, how their service of each other really makes life sweeter. Okay, so we saw that millennials don't have friends, and we'll examine some of the reasons for that. They really lack the character traits as well as the interaction to make it happen. I guess I really like Aristotle's concept here. Mutual affection is a matter of deliberate choice, and it springs from having the mindset, the fixed disposition of having a good relationship. So, basically you do what you set your mind to do. We looked at bad relationships, and I encourage you, if you haven't spent time reflecting on these, to reflect on these and really see, do you have biblical relationships or not? And then we go down to Christlikeness is the goal for us being on this planet. So that friendships fit into that end. If a relationship doesn't help you move more towards being like Christ, why do you have it? Difficulties in friendships, costs in friendships, commandments forbid, blah blah blah. Okay, so now the sermon proper is, if you really want to be friends with other people and have great relationships, you must first be a friend of God, so your needs are met on an infinite level and you're not using the other person to do it. Oh yeah, here it is right there. Emerson, the condition which high friendship demands is the ability to do without it. So could you live without your relationships? I've always One of my tests for thoughts about Christianity is, would that person's Christianity work if they were locked up in solitary confinement for their faith? Could they have joy? Could they have peace? Could they have all the things? You'd have a hard time loving one another, but you can pray for them. And most of the things I test against that fail. So you become a person of worth as a friend of God. Your character becomes more lovable. You have resources for the difficult times in relationships, which are inevitable. And you need to develop the skill set. So toil helps you do that. And then we got the thing that actually spells the acrostic friend. We did FRI, and now we're doing the END. Friends freely share and communicate, but you always have to be other-centered in your speech. It's not just a vent. It's the world's view, not necessarily God's view. Friends share time, they sacrificially love, and then relationships need repair, maintenance, and cultivation. So we looked at that last week. And you're investing both in each other and in a common cause. And the camaraderie that develops in a common cause, which you see on sports teams, military units, good marriages, they have a common cause and it draws them closer together. And C.S. Lewis said, the very condition of having friends is that we should want something else besides friends. So that's kind of taken care of by becoming a friend of God. Okay, END. Here we are, the last part. So, empathy and encouragement. Pythagoras, of Pythagorean theorem fame, a squared plus b squared c squared, was actually the guy who first coined the term philosopher. And in chasing down some of the context of this quote, I came across some ideas that might actually be a sermon for next week. Friends are companions on a journey who ought to aid each other to persevere in the road to a happier life. So I really wanted to, I wasn't able to dig this part up out of his quotes, but he has the right idea. This is like a couple hundred years before guys like Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, those guys did their thing. And Cicero, way before Cicero. So happier life, it's a road to it. And it's a journey. And a journey takes effort, particularly in those days. You know, you didn't have McDonald's along the way. It got hot, it got hard. The roads weren't paved, there were dangers. But companions on a journey aid each other, just like my mountain climb illustration as well. And the unhappy truth is that we can treat our friends shabbily. We don't treat them as they should be treated if they are near and dear to us. In fact, often we show the worst side to our alleged friends, and we use them, particularly in the non-Christian relationships. In Samuel, 2 Samuel, I think David's being or Saul, one of them was, you love your enemies and you hate your friends. And people can actually do that. Particularly when you get the pseudo-Christians. Yeah, they're born again, but they, you're supposed to love your enemies. And then they kind of use and abuse their friends. So that can happen. And we need to be careful to cherish our friendships. Empathy. It means to feel with. So I guess a common expression is, I feel your pain. And if you really mean that, it's actually really good. You understand the pathos of a person, and it gives you a sensitivity to their needs. Insensitive people usually don't have empathy. A little later, we're going to talk about need meeting. And insensitive people just, okay, here's a solution. I don't like having to hear about this. So, just to get fixed and, let me get back to my happy life. That's not really empathy. Empathy is, I feel your pain, but I don't want you to stay in it. And we're going to see in need meeting, if people just want to wallow in their pity, or then you need to fix that. Encouragement, you all know the parakaleo word. It's a big word in scripture. We actually have commands to do this. It means to call alongside, not come alongside. That's a total perversion of the word, and it doesn't fit its context. And the idea is you're climbing the mountain, and you call others alongside. There's another word for it's translated compassion, and it means to speak parables alongside. And the parables are of encouragement. So that one is the come alongside, but not to come alongside and, just share their pain, but to help them get back on the path to the journey. So friends share joys and have sorrows. Cicero, a couple hundred years after my friend Plato, said, "Friendship improves happiness and abates misery by the doubling of our joy and the dividing of our grief." And you see example of this when someone had the lost coin, the woman did, the guy had the lost sheep. When he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors and says to them, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost." So the idea of being able to celebrate with others, celebrate our successes, is an important part of friendship. And when you sing happy birthday, you're basically sharing in the joy of the fact that the person is aging. I mean, no, that they lived another year successfully. And then a lot of people just feel better after they share their story of their tale of woe. And part of it is when you keep things bottled up and don't get them out and process them. This is particularly true of extroverts, but it is also true of introverts, that actually just saying what's bothering you, it's called getting it off your chest, does help you feel better. It also helps you look at things a little more objectively. Is if we're just stuck in our heads, things overwhelm us. And having friends to share with, "Oh, it really bothers me that blah, 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 blah." And the person says, "Yeah, they shouldn't have treated you that way." That is kind of where the world ends. And that's why people say, "I don't want a solution, I just want empathy." But no, there's like a reason why they treated you that way. There's biblical ways to respond to it. And that's going to move us to our next thing on need meeting. But I remember once when I went down to Disney World, my parents and my sister and her spouse, and we went to the haunted house. And Disney World is not that much fun with one person. All the rides are divine with two. And it was particularly brought home to me when we go through the haunted house, and at the end of the haunted house ride, they kind of project a ghost into your hearse that you're riding in, and you realize there's no one sitting next to you except the ghost. Normally it's like ghost between the two people. Like, "Ah, there's a ghost." But it's really so much more fun, both the rides when you have another person that dreams that they're going to lose their life on a roller coaster, and you, or it's they share your terror and it's more fun. So with most of life, it's kind of meant to be shared. God made us to be, the word is gregarious, means being groups. And that's why he created the body as a fellowship of believers that are joined together, that are linked together, that rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. We can do that. It requires a other centered sensitivity to make that happen. Then you can have bad friends. They double your sorrow. When Job's friends heard of this evil, they made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. And they are such bad comforters that they increased his sorrow. They really didn't understand what was going on. They weren't sensitive to the spirit. They just shared platitudes with him till we said, "Oh, what miserable comforters you are." And Job actually complains, "Him that is afflicted, pity should be shown from his friend, and you guys are just causing me more grief." So you need to be careful that you are not adding to a person's grief in your attempts to buck up, buckaroo. Sometimes that's what they need. Friends rejoice in each other's success. So this is a passage from John the Baptist. He does most of the end of John chapter 3. And his disciples came to him and said, they were actually being good friends of John. We're going to see later they defend each other's reputation. "Hey, this guy Jesus is, baptizing more disciples than you are." He's getting a greater following. And John said, "No, that's why I'm here." And John has some really insightful words of recognizing that Jesus came from heaven. He's got the words of the Father. His purpose was to come. He's the one that the scriptures talked about. He's the Messiah. You should pay attention to him. And John says, as an analogy of that, the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, John said, my joy is fulfilled. So when his friend Jesus, who let him stay in prison and get his head cut off, came, he rejoiced because of, you know, this is the Messiah. This was, he was the friend of the bridegroom. And when the bridegroom comes back for his church, I'm sure John will be there shouting hallelujahs. Now, friends don't often or always rejoice in each other's success because they're jealous. They don't have enough worth and value to basically bless others and rejoice and be happy because the other person is successful. A person with bad self-worth, even if they are successful in their own right, their self-images can still be so poor that they can't rejoice in another's success. This is kind of a really poignant thing. I kind of noticed that my mother, who's now the Lord, just was really insecure because of the way she was raised. You know, she was almost like a street kid survivor, even though she had parents, but they totally abandoned her. And she just never had security, even though she goes on and gets advanced degrees. She was elected, you know, holistic nurse of the year for the nation. She just, you know, I think she was in the mid-80s, she was 85, and we're having a birthday party for my father-in-law up at Willowemoc, and, you know, everybody's gathered there, and everybody is talking about him, because it's his 85th birthday, that's what you do. And then my mother gets up, and, you know, this is one of those times I felt like crawling in a hole, starts talking about herself. She says a few words as a segue to herself and then starts talking about herself. And I say, oh, God, please make her stop. she didn't really have a sense of worth and value, which comes from submitting to God and living life on his terms. So she couldn't share that with others. I always kind of wondered whenever, you know, I achieved anything, she, or my sister too, who was a very accomplished person, it was like she would try to upstage us. And then eventually I became aware of how self-image and self-concept really affects our ability to give honor to others because we're not getting honor from God. So there's a sermon on the magic lamp of self-esteem. I talk about how to give that to your kids and a little blurb on how to reparent yourself if you never got that. It's real simple, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I think that's as far as the acrostic goes. And that has helped a lot of people. But, you know, you want to, you know, what do you do at work when if someone, your kind of co-worker that you're friendly with, gets promoted over you? Ugh! The green-eyed monster of jealousy comes. And, you know, it's like, let's sabotage their work so they get fired. You know, this is where being a friend of God helps, because you recognize the sovereignty of God. No good thing is he withhold them who walk uprightly, and you can conclude it's not a good thing for me to have gotten this at this time. It's that simple. Psalm 84:11. So you can be, it's hard when you have your initial disappointment, but then, you know, recognizing that God has choosing this to happen. That's why, you know, understanding God's sovereignty is great. And it's not best for me at this time. So maybe it usually is something better for me. Someone reminded me of, they were listening to the Will of God sermon, of when I was a busboy back, working my way through college, a patron came in. And it was late, and I think the guy was drunk, and because it was kind of late, there weren't other people around to wait on, so I just kind of gave extra attention to his table. And he calls me over, and often I would get, you know, a buck or two from people. He gives me a $20 bill. I said, whoa, you know, are you sure you want to do this? And then I, you know, kind of looked at my other customers, and you know, came back to him again, called me over, and asked for the $20 back. And I said, Yeah, fine. It's, you know, his money, he gave it to me, but, you know, if he wants it back, he probably reconsidered. And I said, yeah, gave it back. And then he reaches into his pocket and takes out a wad of 20s and puts a $20 bill on them. Then he reaches into his other pocket and pulls out a wad of 100s, peels one off and gives it to me. And being willing to give up what I had got me more. And his instructions, which I never really followed, was put it in your shoe and then you'll always have it. I think I spent it for food. You know, I was hungry, so I had it, but I didn't have it. My sock never wore out anyway. So, you know, if you recognize that God, you know, hold things with an open hand is the principle that comes out of that. And it gets rid of jealousy as well. All right, let's see what we got next. Okay, so that is rejoicing in each other's. Then comes need solving. Emerson said, a true friend is someone who can make us do what we can do, live up to our potential, who isn't going to be satisfied with us, you know, being a sluggard about life or spirituality, but, you know, recognizing that we're going to have to give an account for what we do. A verse of the day, which is very appropriate for July 4th, is Galatians, was it 5:13? For brethren, you've been called to liberty, but do not use your liberty as an opportunity to just indulge your flesh, but through love, serve one another. And love is need meeting. God so loved us that he met our need for a substitute for our sin, our need for getting the Spirit within us, our need for getting to heaven and living happily ever after in glory. So true friends are ones who are going, not going to be content to let us just, you know, wallow in our own mess, but want to help us get out of it. And Epicurus said, it's not so much our friend's help that helps as the confidence of their help. And that is what kind of enables us to take risks. Friends also, we're going to see a little later, are mirrors that we can see ourselves through them and recognize and celebrate what is good and recognize and change what is not so good. But having help, it's like when you first rode a bike, those of you who have ridden a bike, you usually had your parent hold on to it so you wouldn't fall over. And it's basically just being willing to catch them when they fall. If you look at gymnasts, you always see someone spotting them. Even weightlifters, the same thing. Just knowing that if you run into difficulty, there is someone there to help. So you are not as anxious about failure as you would otherwise. Now, as Christians, God is our friend. He is our helper. He actually has gone on record saying he is our helper. We always have his help. But just kind of knowing that there's someone else to hold your hand when you're white knuckled and, you know, going through a scary haunted house, is, you know, it gives you courage to do that. So true friend helps us do what we should be able to do. Friends vocally watch out for each other's soul, which means they don't just pray for you, they talk to you. They instruct you. They warn you. They reprove you when you're off the path. They rebuke you when you're in your proudness, you know, just refuse to submit to God and His Word. And then they even reject you to cut you off from fellowship, so that you feel the sting of being out of fellowship and then can repent. In fact, God mandates and commands rejecting those who don't want to follow the Spirit, so they will want to come back and follow the Spirit. If you support them in their sin, you add to their sin and partake of it yourself. That when the passage in Thessalonians, don't even eat with them, so they might be ashamed. Those are commands. Treat them as a publican and a sinner, as Matthew 18. So we watch out for each other's souls. Now, one of the reasons I put together the, you know, Christian career path or the blueprint is I realize people don't know what the Christian life is supposed to be for themselves, much less someone else. So if you kind of look at how it's supposed to be as you mature, you can then watch out for others. If you don't know what the path is, you can't help others get on the path. And then words are required, not just actions. You walk the talk, which means it's got to be a talk that you walk. And then your example of it. Jesus didn't just come down here and be an example. He taught. You look at Paul. He wasn't just a great example. He used words. So ointment and perfume rejoice the heart. In a dry culture, or being able to oil your skin was good. I had a friend from India who, one summer, was reveling in the fact that he was taking a bath in olive oil. It just wasn't the whole bath was olive oil, but he, poured, I don't know how much olive oil into his bath. And then perfume, also, I guess you get smelly in the hot environments, also makes it so you're, plump and fragrant. Something similar to that is the sweetness of a man's friend by hearty counsel. And the word for hearty is soul. So if you're giving, mind, will, and emotions counsel that's correct, it is actually supposed to be good for people. Proverbs 27:6 says, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful." We'd rather have the kisses of the enemy. If you think about children, it's like the rod and reproof give wisdom. Those are wounds. But the kid left to himself, a disgrace to the parent. We would rather have, if you ask a toddler, would you rather have your parent, train you or not? Definitely not. Yet as you grow older, you begin to recognize the wisdom of that. So, yeah, huh? Yeah, so it's a counsel that's concerned about what you think, about what you feel, and what you do. And that what you feel thing, emotions are frequently incorrect because they come from incorrect values. So you're basically going to give a person counsel or advice or God's perspective about all those aspects of their lives. It's not just, no, you cannot wear, plaids and stripes together. That's a fashion faux pas of the highest magnitude. What I'm going to do a little more on that when I get to iron sharpens iron. So faithful are the wounds of a friend. Oh, you really hurt me when you said that. I'm really sorry that those hurt. I couldn't think of any other way to say it, but it's something you really need to hear so you don't do yourself more damage. Self-harm is not good. So this guy, Bulwer Lytton. Bulwer, what a name. I actually came across him. A contest is named in his honor of the worst opening sentences of a novel, and I actually submitted something, but I guess it wasn't bad enough to get an award. But he also has this great quote: "One of the surest evidence of friendship that one individual can display to another is telling him gently of a fault. If any other evidence of friendship can excel telling him gently of a fault, it is listening to such a disclosure with gratitude and amending the error." Now, some people will say, "Oh, thank you for sharing that," and then just continue on doing their sin. And that it's like doubly deceitful because they're being a hypocrite on top of being a sinner. So we need to basically be recognizing that God can use others in our life. And when someone discloses, it's called reproof, brings to light a fault. And normally, the procedure, there's a sermon called Ministry is for Garden Variety Christians. I'm not an Apostle Paul. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a pastor. I'm not this or that. So I went through the scriptures and looked at the commands that were given to individual, everyday believers. One of my favorite passages is in Romans 15, that you're full of goodness and able to admonish one another. One of the things that precedes reproof is instruction, and then warning people that they are not following the instruction, and then bringing to light the, you know, when you actually cite cases of why you're not following the scriptures. And then when they get to, ignore the reproof, there comes rebuke. And the word for encouragement is sometimes translated rebuke, but exhort and rebuke, it's all the same word. You have to figure out the context. But there's a higher level. Before you figure this out is 1 Timothy 4. It says, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season. Reprove, rebuke, and exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine. So there's a difference between reprove and the rebuke, and it comes in that order. So, the person needs to amend the error, not just say, thanks for that. Chinese proverb. I don't know if this is really a Chinese proverb. It sounds like a fortune cookie. Do not use a hatchet to remove a fly from your friend's forehead. So the reason you're tempted to use a hatchet is the thing is bothering you for a long time. And rather than deal with it properly and gently and praying for the person and understanding them and picking the right time to, talk to them about it, or waiting for the right opportunity. That's really one of the tough things about this discipleship is, it's why you need to be in touch with the Spirit of God. When is the right time to bring it up? And sometimes I've had to say, there's really no right time to bring this up. And I kind of need to do what needs to be done in obeying God. You're tempted to use a hatchet. So, you don't want people wanting to use a hatchet on you. You should be self-reproving. You should be reflecting on your life. I've done some sermons on taking heed to yourself. You should be asking God to search you and try you and see if there's any wicked way in you and lead you in the way of life everlasting. If you're doing this, you make life much more pleasant for those around you. You should not be a baby in diapers that constantly need to be changed, that are offense to everyone around you. And you basically need to take responsibility for yourself. And then you make it easier to live with others. Molière, who is a French, he actually has some leanings towards biblicism or Christianity. He's a playwright. He says, the more we love our enemies, the less we flatter them. All right, that's, yeah. What? Oh, our friends. Sorry, my bad. The more we love our friends, the less we flatter them. It is by excusing nothing that pure love shows itself. Yeah, this is a little tough one. There's some things that love is patient, it's kind, it doesn't keep record of faults. The Corinthians were really quick to jump on each other's faults because they were so carnal. Pure love, if you really desire someone else's best interest, you don't let them continue to do what is spiritually suicidal. If you really want to see them do well at the judgment seat, and you say nothing, you share in their sin. Remember the watchman principle of Ezekiel? If the watchman doesn't say anything, then that person's blood or loss of blessing is on your head. If you share it with them, they'll reject you, but then you're free. You can't just pretend that things don't exist. That's not love. It's enabling a person in their sin. And this doesn't happen in most churches because, we don't want anybody to say anything about us. So you get a group of people that really are going to do poorly at the judgment seat because they think, I'm okay because everyone else is doing it. Okay, Jesus was really clear that only the overcomers are the ones who share in the blessings. He was really clear in his very first sermon that the way to life is an uphill, narrow route. The broad way leads to hell, Gehenna. So when many are going to go by that, only a few are going to take the right way. And the more you love people, the more you want them to do well. This does not mean you're kind of like, you know, FBI listening in on everything to try to figure out, oh, what's wrong, or NASA. I don't know, there's lots of government agencies doing this nowadays. Or, you know, you're members of the Communist Party turning in anybody who might say anything unflattering against the government. But you're other-centered. You are aware of things, and God gives you grace to interact with them in love and fellowship and friendliness while you're waiting for the right opportunity to present itself. So timing is really crucial. And you know, if you see someone walking off a cliff, you don't say, well, I think I need to wait until they kind of actually step over the edge. No, that's too late. That's what admonishment, warning them of the consequences. You keep going down that path, something unpleasant is going to happen to you. So we watch out for each other's souls. A good friend who points out mistakes and imperfections and rebukes evil is to be respected as if he reveals a secret of hidden treasure. Buddha chapter, oops, no, that's not in the Bible. So, you know, Buddha got his stuff by reflecting on life. And there are a couple other people I've quoted in here that are not biblicists. And, you know, we need to treasure someone who will tell us the truth and tell us what we don't want to hear. Good CEOs don't want yes men. Good CEOs want someone that's going to tell them the truth. Bad CEOs will fire someone who tells them the truth, because good CEOs want their company to prosper. Bad managers tolerate bad employees. You know, HR kind of and lawyers have kind of made that more prevalent. But, you know, do we really value someone who tells us that we're not doing too well? And then, of course, you have the immature believers who kind of make a, you know, Christian career out of being inappropriate in, you know, sharing, you know, their individual scruples. We just studied this in Romans 14. Become mandatory for everyone else. Open rebuke, says Proverbs 27, is better than secret love. So if someone says something to you and you don't like it, realize that they risked a lot to do it, and you might want to consider, take it to God and say, is there truth in this? Even if what they say is, you don't think is the problem that they stated, there is some problem. He that rebukes a person afterward shall find more favor than he that flatters with the tongue. This has not been very true in my experience, but it's the truth. And there are very few people who really want to take holiness seriously. Be holy as he is holy. So it's in Proverbs, general wisdom. But here in a prayer, Psalm 141, the beginning context is the wicked are actually enticing this person. The wicked are those who know God's word and aren't practicing it, which would, you know, fit a lot of Christians these days. And the psalmist prays, God, don't incline my heart to any evil thing, to practice wicked works with men who work iniquity, and do not let me eat of their delicacies. It's a great prayer. He recognizes that it's where your heart is, there your actions will be. And if you incline your heart to something evil, you'll wind up doing evil. It's that simple. And he doesn't want that, and he doesn't even want to eat of their delicacies. So that means you're willing to be excluded from that. Then he says, let the righteous strike me. Ow, it shall be a kindness. And let him rebuke me. Tell me that I'm wrong. It will be as excellent oil. Let not my head refuse it. For still my prayers against the deeds of the wicked. This last verse here is, someone said there's as many views on this as there are commentators. And it, you know, I kind of started looking at what other people said. And yeah, it's this translation, I think, captures the context really well. Even if you don't have a righteous person strike you or rebuke you, you're still praying that you won't be doing the deeds of the wicked, which is what he wants to avoid to begin with. He doesn't want to practice the wicked works. That's up here in verse 4, so this one fits there. This parallelism, it's probably the best thing. But, you know, if, first of all, we don't want the righteous strike, we would like to be able to learn to listen at the low volume. And I frequently said this, and it bears repeating, learn to listen at the low volume, which is in your quiet time. You read the scriptures, you ask God to see if it matches what your life is. You pray Psalm 139, see if there's any wicked man in me. And then you won't have to have people strike you, what you perceive as a strike. Then you hear sermons and address sermons to needs that I'm aware of in the body. And I do my happy dance in secret when I hear that people have actually intended that a person respond to this truth. Because I'm asking God, God, show me needs in the body that need to be addressed by your truth. And it's a nice, you know, safe, non-confrontational way. This is what the truth says. And a person's thinking, am I obeying that? And then they realize, oh, I'm not obeying it, and I need to change. Then the next volume is, we used to have people work on going over the sermon with others because people couldn't understand what I said. And then you could highlight the things that, you know, what do you think about that verse? So churches used to have discussed the sermon Sunday schools, which I think is an excellent idea because you only take in less than 10% of what you hear. Then eventually it gets into, hey, can we get together? You know, I want to talk to you about something. It's much better that you don't have to get it up to that. It's just little comments in passing. But when the person's not receptive and you're praying for them and you're praying for the opportunity, then you do need to step up the volume and meet their need. And if they receive it graciously, all is good. If they don't, you know, you're suffering for doing what's right. And God is just heaping up judgment on them. Actually, they're heaping up judgment on themselves. Under this one, friends make us sharp and effective. Cicero said, to give counsel as well as to take it is a feature of true friendship. And that is decent. I thought of that, Psalm 27, Proverbs 27, 17. Iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. I heard this when I started getting around Christian fellowship, and the thing they always said is, when iron sharpens iron, sparks fly. It doesn't have to be that way. There's easier ways to do it. But there's another piece. The way iron sharpens iron, you'll see chefs do this with their steel. And you also see them do it with two knives. And the thing is, as you cut something, the blade, the sharpness comes back and gets dull. And then when you sharpen it from the correct direction, you put that burr back. But in order for that to happen, the first knife has to be sharp. So you can't be a dull knife and think you can sharpen others. It won't work. You need to work on being sharp and having your dull places made sharp so you're in a better position to sharpen others. To give counsel as well as take it is a feature of true friendship. What was this guy? Publius says, reprove your friends in secret, praise them openly. And that's really the way it should work, so you don't embarrass them. When I was teaching at university, I had to make sure I I would ask for questions, and because students hadn't done preparation, they would give stupid answers. And I would have to distance my response because their self-worth was so at stake. Well, that's interesting. Okay, anyone else? Yeah. And then, you know, they eventually caught on that, you know, the one that I kind of, like, this also happens in Bible study. The one, you want to, people have their worth and value in the wrong things. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. So friends can pull out thorns, and Dracles and the lion pulls the thorn out of it. There's a mouse and a lion, and the mouse comes because the lions, they're howling, my paw. And the little mouse goes to pull it out, and then they become friends for life until the lion eats them for a snack. No, he doesn't do that. But, you know, there are things that hinder us. And sometimes we can't do it ourselves. And God has designed the body, so really there's stuff we are not going to be able to do without the help of others, because he wants us to be humble. And needing help from others is humble. Humility. George Canning, I looked up, he was a prime minister, an Irishman, prime minister of England, had lots of good friends and lots of enemies. And he said, "Give me the avowed, the erect, the manly foe. Bold I can meet, perhaps may turn the blow. But of all plagues, good heaven, your wrath can send. Save, oh, save me from the candid friend." Who's going to, basically, the candid friend is going to tell him there's something wrong. So he'd much rather, you know, battle someone face to face than have to deal with having to battle himself inwardly as a result of some advice from a candid friend. So it's semi-humorous, but there's some truth in that. Friends help meet needs. So we have the parable of the friend at night. This word for importunity is actually honor. Friends meet needs. So give me three loaves, and he won't rise because he is his friend, because of his importunity. It means you keep bugging him. The better word is honor. Poet and peasant by a guy called Bailey. Understands the Middle Eastern culture extremely well, and I think I reference where they find that on Daily Truth Base. But they help meet needs. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. So that means family, siblings, are not for all times, but friends are. So actually, there's a friend that sticks closer than a brother. Friends are people that we can do fun things with. Family, sometimes not so much. In terms of meeting needs and serving others, the place where this was first brought home to me was it was my last year at college. Took that long. I wound up living with some Christians, and I was told that they needed a roommate, and I had another place, and it fell through, and then I needed a roommate. And it turns out they didn't need a roommate. Two guys doubled up so they could basically have an influence in my life, and they did. And my friend Mark, who had this influence, was an Iowa farm boy. He worked with his hands real well, and he actually had a job in the bus depot for the university. And one day he asked if he could borrow my car. And I said, "I'm a nice guy. Sure." So he takes my car, brings it to the bus depot on his own time, washes it, tunes it up, fills it with gas, and brings it back. And I said, "Where'd you go?" Whatever. And he told me what he did. My jaw dropped. And I realized that, you know, serving, you know, even in something that wasn't a need, looking out for what would please someone, what would be beneficial. My car probably did need a tune up. Because I hadn't tuned it up since I got it, is really, you know, a great model. You don't, Jesus did not have to do all the nice stuff that he did, but he went above and beyond, and believers through the years have done that as well. Friends warn each other. This one is particularly Paul going into the theater at Ephesus. This is where the people are for a couple hours demonically chanting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," and because the silver workers realized their trade was being impacted by people following Christianity, and the disciples were in there, and Paul wanted to go in and help them, but his friends, the disciples, begged him not to go in because it was going to cause more of a riot, and then some officials sent to him pleading that he would not venture into the theater, and he didn't. So he listened. Friends refresh each other. So Paul was courteously treated by a governor who gave Paul liberty to go to his friends to refresh himself. So he was, you know, under house arrest of something, but was let loose to do that. I think, oh yeah, if a friend is in trouble, don't annoy him by asking him anything he can do. Think of something appropriate and do it. Yeah, take the initiative in serving. Over the years, we've hosted a lot of folks, and we've had groups at our houses. There, the people come in and say, "Is there anything I can help with?" Say no, say no, say no. And then there are other people who come in who say, "Hey, I can do that. Why don't you do something else?" So they look, they see what they can do, they realize that there are other things that I could do, and they take over and do it. So friends have to take the initiative to help meet needs. Okay, now we're at the D. 7 minutes. Friends defend life and reputation. To your own friend, father's friend, don't forsake them. It's better to have a neighbor near than a brother far away. Friends are loyal to an other's reputation. And this is a key mark. So one of the things that frequently happens is people will speak against an other. That's actually the Greek word for blaspheme. The context is speaking against God. Paul got spoken against a lot. He handed some people over to Satan so that they would learn or be taught not to blaspheme. So Pilate sought to release Jesus, but after hearing the charges against him in John 19, Jews cried out, "If you let this man go, you're not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar, and you're supporting this guy. So Caesar is going to hear that you're not his friend." That's what friends are supposed to do. They defend another's reputation. It's loyalty. As you now know, in China, they have this national security law, which really is, if you say anything against the state, you are in violation and disappear. Friendship demands discriminatory allegiance. This is a key concept in understanding loving God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength before you love your neighbor as yourself. You can't be a serve mammon or money and God. It's a digital thing. You're either serving one or you're serving the other. You can't do both. On the path to glory, you can't take the path to the world. You can, take one step along each path, and then you're doing a split. They're going in two different directions. And James pointed this out to the believers and recipients of his letters. He said, "You adulterers and adulteresses." Okay, what's an adulterer? That's a person who is married to another, who is having an illicit, illegal affair, sleeping with a person who they had not vowed fidelity to. Adulterous, same thing. So frequently God calls Israel a harlot because that was his wife and they were serving other gods, idols. Don't you know that friendship with the world is enmity or hostility with God? Whoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. So I asked you at the beginning, are you a friend of God? If you are, you cannot be a friend of the world. You can't be serving money and serve God. You're looking to God for the protection, to God for the benefits. It's one or the other. What are you trusting in? A proverb that I mentioned earlier, Proverbs 3. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Previous one. Do not rely on your own thinking, which frequently is too worldly. But in all your ways acknowledge God, and he will make your path straight. Similarly, sometimes you have to pick between friends. You can't be loyal to someone who hates the person that you are loyal to. Discriminatory allegiance. It's made more clear on the God plane and on the civil governmental plane. But it's also true of the others. Two are better than one, says Ecclesiastes, says Solomon, because they have a good reward for their labor. If they fall, one can lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when they fall, for he has no one to help him rise. So friends help each other, and can two walk together unless they are agreed? They can't. So they have to be like-minded to have a really good friendship. You can have acquaintances, but basically, if you have to choose, it's like Jonathan and David, which is coming up next. He couldn't be loyal to the king, his father, and loyal to David. Yet he was, and he sought to protect and defend David even at his own expense. So friends make soul sweaters. What's that mean? Well, if you ever, their hearts were knit together. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul, says 1 Samuel 18. So I've seen lots of people knit sweaters. They have yarn, and sometimes they bring in another color, and the two of them are, they do some magic with the needles, and lo and behold, you now have the two knit together in a sweater. And that kind of is the way we should be. We become intertwined with each other. Our lives mesh, and we have the fabric of friendship. Contrast that with a quote from Sivananda. He's some famous yogi, started Divine Light Mission or something like that. It's from a total world view. Its major tenet is basically you are a god. You can obviously see it's demonic. But here's what he said. Rely on your own self, your own inner strength. Stand on your own feet. Do not depend on money, on friends, or anyone. When friends are put to the test, they will desert you. that's really an accurate picture of the world's view of life. Friends will desert you. Jesus's friends desert him. I'll go to the cross with you. Well, eventually you will, but in the meantime, you're going to desert me. Couldn't you watch 1 hour? Eh. So you want to have friendships that are centered in God. The closer you can get to God, the closer you can get to each other. And in your friendship, you have some responsibilities. The last three we looked at today, and with defending the life and reputation. No greater love has anyone than this, that they lay down their life for their friend. I think Jesus said that. It's probably a good thing. Okay, any questions?
I have one question about, I think Jesus was talking about when friends cannot celebrate other success, is it implying that they are comparing yourself to another?
Okay, when friends can't celebrate another's success, does that imply that they are comparing themselves to another? Yeah, that's part of it. It often, in the promotion thing, I'm better than they are. You probably are, but that's just, it's not in God's plan for you, otherwise you'd be there at the time. There's competition that goes on. You can see this particularly among siblings. They do that as well. Any questions from the other part of the world? Okay, then, work on being a friend of God. And you got some skills and activities to develop in your life. Do the skills first and work on the activities. And we don't have to think about being friends anymore. Okay, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you have enabled us to be your friends, as you called Abraham and David, friends of God. May we have a heart that is aligned with your heart. May we value your reputation above our own. May we value the people that you put into our life as friends to help us be sanctified, to help us grow, to help us rejoice in our joys and grieve in our sorrows. Thank you that we have examples in the scripture of the friendships that believers have that enabled them to endure tough times. May our friendships stand that test as well. Thanks for your truth. This time together in Christ's name. Amen.